Amen. So let's turn our attention to the notes, and we will begin looking at a portion of this passage, Toldot, Generations. And we'll look at a passage in Genesis, beginning with Genesis 25:19, where the Parsha starts. And then from there, we're going to look at an article, as we are doing this season, from Jonathan Sacks that's entitled, The Other Face of Esau. So the Torah passage begins, "This is the story of Isaac, son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took wife Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, sister of Laban, the Aramean. Isaac pleaded with the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and the Lord responded to his plea, and his wife Rebekah conceived. But the children struggled in her womb, and she said, 'If so, why do I exist?' She went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord answered her, 'Two nations are in your womb. Two separate peoples shall issue from your body. One people shall be mightier than the other, and the older shall serve the younger.' When her time to give birth was at hand, there were twins in her womb. The first one emerged red, like a hairy mantle all over. So they named him Esau. Then his brother emerged, holding on to the heel of Esau. So they named him Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when they were born. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the outdoors. But Jacob was a mild man who stayed in camp. Isaac favored Esau because he had a taste for game. But Rebekah favored Jacob." So what we see here in this opening portion, when the boys are this opening passage of the portion, the story of Isaac in this part here of Genesis 25:19 is interrupting the genealogies that we see earlier in chapter 25. And so this, we were looking at the life of Isaac, and then there's an interruption with the, if you will, of the genealogies. And so with this portion, verse 19, there's a resuming, a coming back to the main emphasis being on Isaac, and in particular now the birth of Esau and Jacob and the rivalry between them. And these narratives that we're looking at present an ancient belief that the bitter hostility that marked the later relationships between the peoples of Israel and Edom had its origin in the prenatal experience of their founding fathers, who were the twins. So as we look now at the article from Jonathan Sacks, I would invite you to keep in the forefront of your mind the main characters of the narrative, if you will, Jacob and Esau. And we know that Jacob is the father of Israel, and Esau is the father of the Edomites. And so they are related, they're siblings, and you might have heard references to a sibling rivalry. And we're going to be looking at that picture, at least in part, but we're going to be looking at it from the point of view, we're trying to appreciate the point of view of Esau, because typically we look at it from the point of view of Jacob. But today we're going to look at some particular points that the Torah portion presents for us that gives us some interesting insights into the person in the life of Esau. And as we move forward, what I invite you to do is to keep in forefront that these are two brothers, they're twins, and the peoples that come from each of them are connected by blood, but there's a tension in that connection. And on one hand, we see that Jacob and Israel are the chosen. Esau and Edom are not chosen. And I highlight those two phrases, the chosen and the not chosen, intentionally. And this is part of what Sachs is going to present and talk about, but I want to kind of give you a forerun, if you will, of appreciating the difference, and in the difference, a tension that exists between those that are chosen and those that are not chosen. So let's look at the article from Jonathan Sachs entitled, The Other Face of Esau. Sachs writes, the Torah is an understated text, sparse in the details, elusive and elusive. Elusive meaning it's hard to find. Elusive meaning working by suggestion. So referencing the Torah, that it's often sparse in its details, elusive and elusive about the inner life of the characters. Yet in Parsha Toldot, we are shown one of the most emotionally affecting scenes in the Torah. Jacob, dressed in Esau's clothes, has taken Esau's blessing. He leaves, and shortly thereafter, his brother, and we're reading now from a later portion in, or later part of this portion in Genesis 27. His brother Esau came in from hunting. He too had prepared some tasty food and brought it to his father. Then he said to him, my father, sit up and eat some of my game so that you may give me a blessing. So what follows here is what Sachs is referencing, how the Torah unusually goes into detail about the emotions of an individual, and in this case, two individuals, Esau and Isaac. His father Isaac asked him, who are you? I am your son, he answered, your firstborn Esau. Isaac trembled violently and said, who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? I ate it just before you came in, and I blessed him, and indeed he will be blessed. When Esau heard his father's words, he cried a loud and bitter cry and said to his father, bless me, me too, my father. But he said, your brother came deceitfully and took your blessing. Esau said, is he not rightly named Jacob, heel grabber? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took my birthright, and now he has taken my blessing. And then he asked, haven't you kept any blessing for me? Isaac answered Esau, I have made him lord over you and have made all his brethren his servants, and I have sustained him with corn and new wine. What then can I do for you, my son? Esau said to his father, do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me too, my father. Then Esau lifted his voice and wept. What is remarkable is less what happens than how the Torah describes it. It's less about what has actually happened, and it's much more about how Torah is describing it. Its use of language and narrative art. In general, the Torah is sparing in its details, especially about the emotional state of its characters. Its descriptions are minimalist, leaving the reader to supply what the text omits, what the characters look like, their location, body language, and so on. Emmanuel Levinas was surely correct in seeing this as an invitation to Midrash, summoning the reader to complete the text in dialogue with the written word. The Torah is more like radio than television. And I don't know how this strikes some of you, but it strikes me. I'm too young to remember the old days of radio. But I grew up with my father telling me all about it, how as a child growing up in the Depression era of the United States, that the only form of entertainment was an old radio that one of the family members had. In fact, I don't even think it was his parents. It was an uncle. And they would gather together in the evening and to listen to the old dramas that was notorious in old time radio. And so, again, I'm too young to really remember those days experientially. But it strikes me when Sachs references that Torah is more like radio than television, actively enlisting, he says, the imaginative participation of its hearers. This is then a passage, usually in literary explicitness and psychological depth of drama. As readers, Sachs says, we feel with for Isaac and Esau. And this is intentional. The Torah is drawing intentionally with its use of this language for you and I to be drawn into the characters of Isaac and Esau. We are drawn into their subjective states. We enter into Isaac's dawning realization that he has been deceived. We identify too with Esau, who first thought not of the betrayal or desire for revenge, but simple, sharp, and shocking pain. Bless me too, my father. Can you feel that pain when you hear those words? I mean, take a moment and just set aside everything that you know about Esau that comes later. And even the things that the Torah has mentioned about him up to this point. Kind of set that aside and just see Esau for the man that he is, for the son of Isaac that he is. And he cries out in that sense of bitter grief, bless me. Me too, my father. You know, it's one thing that if you saw a grown man saying this to his father, that's touching enough. But imagine a little child looking up at daddy, a five-year-old, a six-year-old, a seven-year-old boy looking up at daddy saying, bless me, daddy, me too, me too. And I'm a parent. I raised three children. And I remember I would play with one of my children. And then the other one would come around and say, me too, daddy, me, daddy. And I might be wrestling with one boy on the floor. And then the other one would come over and want me to wrestle with him. And even my daughter, she wanted that kind of attention too. And, you know, me too. And as a parent, and even as a grandparent, because I do this with my own grandkids still, I feel these words based on my own experience. And I think that that's what Sachs is saying to us, is that the Torah is written in a way with a language in this portion specifically to do just that. To draw you and I in an empathetic, maybe even a sympathetic way. Let's continue with the article. Then comes Isaac's helplessness. What then can I do for you, my son? And Esau's agonizing weeping, all the more poignant given what we know of him, that he is a man of the fields, rough in some ways, impetuous in others, not a man given, as Joseph will be later, referring to Jacob's son that he will eventually have by the name of Joseph. And of course, we know of Joseph's tears when he is in Egypt. So drawing a contrast that Esau is not a man given to tears in comparison to someone like Joseph. The scene of the two of them together, father and son, talking about Isaac and Esau, deceived and disappointed, robbed of what should have been a moment of great tenderness and intimacy, the son feeding his father, the father blessing his son. An intimate moment is lost. And both of these men are deeply affected. We can imagine the painting Rembrandt might have made of it. And Rembrandt, considered one of the masters of the art world, was known for his paintings that depicted great passion and emotion. And I just threw in as an example one of those paintings that he's known for, The Binding of Isaac. And it and notice the emotion that Rembrandt is able to depict in a non-vocal way. And this is what Sachs is connecting us to. And I simply put the image there as a reference point for your benefit. Continuing with the article, Sachs writes, "The question is why this level of detail is necessary. In Torah, form follows function." And I don't know if that's a phrase that you're familiar with. I don't want to be insulting of your intelligence, but I provided an extra footnote that's not a part of Sachs's article, but I wanted to footnote what is meant by the phrase form follows function. And the idea is that the shape of an object should primarily relate to its intended function or purpose. So the form would be the shape. And there is a philosophical idea that the shape determines functionality. But in this case, Sachs is making the point that Torah generally follows the pattern that the form follows the function. In other words, functionality and purpose is established first, and then the form that supports the function comes afterwards. So he goes on to make the point that in Torah, nothing is accidental. And this is critically, critically, critically important that we all understand this. As students of Torah, as ones who will teach Torah, that we understand that everything in Torah is by design and purpose, and it is not accidental. You may have heard this phrase or this comment before. I know that Bob has referenced it on several occasions, that in Torah, every word is important, every letter of the words, and the spaces between the letters. All of it carries a purpose and the message of God to his people. And so that is what Sachs is communicating here, is that this style and this intensity of graphic language that pulls you and I in to connect on an emotional level with Isaac and Esau is not accidental, because Torah follows the pattern of form following function. Then the function of this text is to evoke our emotion, thus the form that's in place to do that, the linguistic form that's pulling you and I in on an emotional level. Sachs continues, "If there is a marked stylistic feature to a given section, it is there for a reason. Here, the Torah wants our sympathies to be drawn throughout the chapter to Esau rather than to Jacob. It is not that we feel that Esau was the rightful heir of the covenant, that history had taken a wrong turn, that things should have been otherwise. Manifestly, this is not so. Rebekah favors Jacob, and in Genesis, mothers know their children better than their fathers do." That's just an interesting comment there for maybe now and later for you and I to reflect upon, that in Genesis, mothers know their children better than fathers. Esau, the hunter, the man who despised his birthright once he had sold it, was clearly not destined to be the faithful follower of an invisible, transcendent God. The Abrahamic covenant must surely pass through Jacob, the child described as a quiet man, staying among the tents. Yet, nonetheless, the Torah goes out of its way, using unusual devices of style, to enlist our sympathies with Esau, to make us enter his world and see things from his perspective. Why? Why is this the case? Before we can answer this, we must first take a wider look at what we know of Esau and his descendants from the rest of the Torah. So we're going to look at several aspects that addresses the character in the life of Esau. The first is that Esau does receive a blessing from Isaac. And here's the blessing as recorded in Genesis 27, verse 39 and 40. The fat places of the earth will be your dwelling. You can still have the dew of heaven, but you shall live by your sword. You may have to serve your brother, but when your complaints mount up, you will throw his yoke off of your neck. The fat places of the earth and the dew of heaven are not so circumscribed, implies Isaac, that they will not be enough for both of you. In other words, the idea of the fat places of the earth and the dew of heaven are resources that God has provided on the earth that is sufficient for Jacob and his family and descendants and for Esau and his descendants. This is a blessing both sons can enjoy without one diminishing the other. As for Jacob's supremacy, it will last only as long as he does not misuse it. If he acts with unwarranted high-handedness, Esau will simply throw his yoke off his neck. There is a basis here for coexistence. And I think before we can even move on further, we want to take a moment to really appreciate this vital point. It sets up a principle of Torah that even when one has been blessed of the Lord to be in a position of wealth, a position of power, a position of influence, where others are either bowing down to that wealth and power and influence, or others are served and benefited by that power, that wealth, and that influence, that even for those who have been blessed of the Lord as such, that if they misuse their wealth, if they misuse their power, if they misuse their influence, and what Sachs describes as an unwarranted high-handedness, that others will then begin to throw that yoke off of their neck. And that is what essentially Isaac says to Esau. It might be that you will serve your brother, but if your complaints mount up and there's a sufficient amount of complaint because of your brother's high-handedness, then you can throw that yoke off your neck and no longer be subject to following and serving your brother. And that's a little different than how sometimes commentary narrates the story. It's often been that the comment is that in perpetuity, Edom or Esau and his people will be subservient to Israel in perpetuity. But in fact, that blessing has a condition based upon how things may or may not go in the future. So think about that for a moment, that it's the past that comments on the future and the future comments on the past. So this introduces an idea, or I would like to introduce the idea of what's called a zero-sum game. And some of you may be familiar with that as a phrase, but I wanted to share a little information because it's connected to what Sachs is talking about. In game theory and in economic theory, there's the idea that's called a zero-sum game. And it's a mathematical representation of a situation in which a participant in the game or the economy has a gain or a loss of something that's a resource or utility for them. And that gain or loss is exactly balanced against others who participate. If the total gains of all of the participants are added up and the total losses are added up and then subtracted from the gains, you will always get the number zero. That's a zero-sum game. And it's illustrated, imagine a cake that you have baked. And you're going to serve it to your guests or to your family and friends. And you cut the cake. and you cut the cake and you give someone a piece, there is less cake to serve. And if everyone appreciates that this, the value of the cake is dependent upon the size of the slice, so one person gets a large slice, another person gets a small slice, one person has the gain of more than the other person who has a small gain. And that's the illustration of what a zero-sum game is that unless you are intentional to give everyone an equal share or an equal slice, in a zero-sum game, there are winners and there are losers. And that is how this story is often seen, and that is Sachs's point, is that this relationship that Jacob and Esau have with each other and the conditions that both of them experience from Isaac's blessing is often viewed as a zero-sum game. There's a winner and there's a loser. Let's return to the article and see how all of this kind of comes together. The second insight comes from Esau's when he marries out, taking two Hittite girls as wives. This is a source of bitterness to Isaac and Rebekah and provides Rebekah with a necessary pretext to reconcile Isaac with Jacob, as well as giving Jacob a legitimate excuse to leave home. "I am disgusted with life because of those Hittite women," she tells Isaac. "If Jacob marries such a Hittite girl from the daughters of this land, why should I go on living?" Esau's reaction is interesting. He understood that the Canaanite girls were displeasing to his father Isaac, and he tries to ameliorate the situation by taking a third wife, Mahalat, daughter of Ishmael. The gesture fails for two obvious reasons. He does not divorce the other wives, and he does not internalize the fact that Ishmael too has been rejected as an heir to the Abrahamic covenant. Esau is not overly endowed with intelligence, but he cares for his father and does not wish to cause him distress. The third glimpse into Esau's character is offered when the brothers finally meet again 22 years later. This is one of the great passages of the Torah, full of depths and resonances. But the surface narrative is clear, and there is a rabbinic principle. Scripture does not depart from its plain meaning. And so if you've been a part of in previous teachings of Bob, you will remember he has talked quite a bit about pardes. And so pardes is a rabbinical way of interpreting passages in Torah. And we know in pardes there is the peshat, the surface meaning of the text. And then there is the derash or the midrash that is a secondary meaning of the text. And the secondary meaning, the midrash, never violates the surface meaning or the peshat meaning. In other words, well, however you and I might interpret a Torah passage, if our interpretation violates the peshat or the surface text, the plain meaning of the text, then our interpretation, however much we feel that it's right, it isn't, it is wrong. Because whatever interpretation we have, it cannot, it must not ever violate the plain meaning of the text. Jacob is full of fear in advance of the encounter. Fear that leads him to make an elaborate preparations involving prayer, diplomacy, and war. The night before the fateful meeting, he wrestles alone with an unnamed adversary. Yet when the brothers finally meet, look what happens when they finally get together. Esau runs to meet Jacob, embraces him, weeps, and shows none of the hostility that he once harbored against Jacob. The internal drama of what was Jacob was anticipating, all of that drama and all those preparations to try to disarm Esau. All of that drama is played out entirely within the soul of Jacob. None of it is realized. In other words, Jacob was worried for no reason. Jacob was upset. He took a lot of drastic measures to avoid what he perceived as a threat, but never manifested in actual danger. And this is a really valid point that is relevant for the world that you and I live in, because so many people often say, I am stressed out. And usually when people talk about being stressed out, they will list lots of things in the outer environment, things that they're perceiving as a threat or imagining to be fearful, and almost never manifest in real danger. Now, there are people who are exposed to real danger, and there are people who are experiencing real danger. And in this moment, I am not talking about them. Because when a person is in real danger, then it takes an active reaction to prepare to defend yourself, to defend those that you care about, and to protect what is yours. When a person is in real danger, reaction saves lives. But it's not the day-to-day experiences of being in real danger or exposed to real danger that most people find so stressing. For most people, particularly people in the Western world, but this would be true for people around the world, who are not faced or experiencing real danger, but rather are perceiving threat because things are not going the way they would like for them to go. See, there's a difference between things not going the way I would like for them to go and being in actual danger. So you might want to ask yourself this question and kind of reflect on it for a moment. With where you're sitting at right now in your home or your office, wherever you might be, are you in danger? In this moment, are you in danger? I'm not asking, do you feel safe? I'm asking, are you in danger? If one is in real danger, then one should act to preserve life. But when we perceive a threat, as Jacob is perceiving a threat that never manifested, but in fact, instead of seeing aggressive hostilities from his brother, he is met with a brother who runs to him and hugs him and weeps and is emotionally connecting with his brother after 22 plus years of separation. But think about all that Jacob went through the days leading up to this, and particularly the night before. All of the emotional anguish that Jacob goes through, not because he's in actual danger, but only because he perceived threat where there is no threat. Let you focus on that and dwell on that for a moment, and I'm going to continue with this article. The internal drama is played out entirely within the soul of Jacob. Esau, it seems, is swift to anger, equally swift to forget. When Jacob, pleading with him to accept a gift of cattle and flocks, uses the deeply significant phrase, "Please accept my blessing," an implicit reference to that event from 22 years earlier when he himself, Jacob, was blessed. Esau shows no sign of understanding at what his brother Jacob is hinting at. Esau does not harbor a grudge. Now think about this. Esau does not harbor a grudge, not because Esau has forgiven, but because simply Esau has forgotten. He just doesn't remember. The fourth passage, Genesis 36, is a list of Esau's descendants. At first glance, it is no different from many other genealogies in Genesis, but it contains two significant pieces of information, one explicit and one implicit. The first is the statement, "These are the kings who ruled in the land of Edom before any king reigned in Israel." The second is the contrast between the closing verse of 36 and the opening verse of 37. "These are the tribes of Esau, each with its own settlements in its hereditary lands. Meanwhile, Jacob lived in the land where his father had lived as an alien." The implication could not be clearer. Esau's descendants established for themselves geographically and politically long before Jacob's family did. Not for them the twists and turns of covenantal history. In other words, the Jews experienced exile, slavery, redemption, and the wilderness years, while both twins may eventually inherit what Isaac said, the fat places of the earth and the dew of heaven. Both Jacob and Esau will inherit that. Both their descendants will inherit that. For one of them, the route is straightforward. For the other, it's anything but straight. In other words, for Esau, he and his people were established in the land that was promised to them and resourced and experienced a stable government much sooner than the Israelites did. The fifth element that must be taken into account is the shape of the relationship between the Israelites and the Edomites. God instructs the Israelites like this in Deuteronomy chapter 2. "You are passing by the borders of your brothers, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. Although they fear you, be careful not to provoke them. I will not give you even 1 foot of their land, since I have given Mount Seir as Esau's inheritance." No less emphatic is the command, Deuteronomy 23, "Do not abhor an Edomite, since he is your brother." There is nothing in these commands to remind us of the eternal strife between the two nations, predicted before they were born. Two nations are in your womb. One people will be stronger, the other, and the older will serve the younger. During the biblical era, there were periodic tensions and shifting fortunes in the relationship between Edom and Israel. But normatively, the Israelites were commanded to respect both the Edomites and their land. Now, combining all of these elements that we've been talking about in Sachs's article, he's going to pull them together now, these points, and let's see how they come together. Combining all these elements, we make several inferences. At the simplest level, there is a humanity here that defies all stereotypes and conventional categorizations. Esau is a child loved by his father and loving him in return. There is a lot of love between Esau and his father Isaac. It's true that Esau did things that displeased his father, but Esau always loved Isaac. And Isaac always loved Esau. This is so striking, Sachs writes, that despite the generally negative evaluation of Esau in the Midrashic literature, this fact shines through. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, "No man ever honored his father as I did mine, yet I found that Esau honored his father even more than I did." There is at times a tendency on the part of the Midrash to separate biblical characters into holy good and holy bad. And for this, there are good pedagogic reasons, as Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Hajes points out. To serve effectively as role models, biblical heroes must be seen as consistently heroic, non-heroes as systematic villains. Yet, Sachs writes, beneath this overlay of Midrash, the Torah teaches a different and equally important message, albeit one that demands a certain maturity to appreciate. Even heroes have their faults, and non-heroes their virtues. And these virtues are important to God. I would like to repeat that. Even heroes have their faults, and non-heroes their virtues. Now, I have to admit that that is a striking and profound idea. And I think I have always readily understood that heroes were not perfect. And they were flawed characters. Noah, Abraham, Moses, David, you know, the impetuousness of Peter, James and John, sons of thunder, as they are described. And even the apostle Paul himself is often seen as aggressive in his personality. And so it's something I've been able to appreciate that heroes are not perfect. But it's an entirely another idea to understand that those who are not the heroes, those who are maybe even sometimes in some categorization seen as a villain, have virtues. And those virtues are important to God. One of the greatest blessings that Israel ever received was from Balaam, a prophet who was paid money to go and curse Israel. But every time he opened his mouth, instead of a curse, a blessing came out. And one of the greatest blessings ever given to Israel, it's a blessing that was turned into a song and is sang in Israel to this day, emanated from the mouth of the character of Balaam, a non-hero. Sachs writes, "The Holy One, blessed be he, does not withhold the reward of any creature," said the sages. The Esau who emerges from the Torah has none of Abraham's faith, does not have Isaac's steadfastness or Jacob's persistence. He is carved out of an altogether coarser grain, but he is not without his humanity. His filial loyalty and a decent, if quick-tempered, disposition. This, too, is part of the Torah's message. Just as we cannot predict God's actions in advance, for instance, in the idea, I will be what I will be, I will have mercy and show kindness to whomever I desire, so we cannot predict in advance where God's image will shine in the affairs of mankind. It was the sectarians of Qumran, not the rabbis, who divided mankind into the children of light and the children of darkness. Such an anthropological dualism is as alien to Judaism as is theological dualism. And so what is dualism? The idea of dualism, whatever the context, it may be anthropological or it might be theological. It might be a dualism in mental health, behavioral health. There's a dualism that exists in education and in literary circles. Whatever the context, the idea of dualism is that meaning is either on or it's off. It is one way or the other. This dualism is binary. It's either good or bad, with no space or room in between for variations. You might have heard the phrase, it's either black or white. It's either right or wrong. It's either good or bad. That's the idea, the concept of dualism. And Sachs is representing that this idea that there are those who are the children of the light versus those who are children of darkness is not an idea that originates with the rabbis. It originates with a sect of individuals, part of the Qumran community. He writes, there is, however, something far more fundamental at stake in the story of Esau. It has to do with the very concept of chosenness itself. And remember, I mentioned at the beginning of this study to keep in mind the idea of the ones chosen and the ones not chosen. There can be no doubt that chosenness has deep psychological consequences on both sides of the equation. To be chosen means, as it was in Jacob's case, who is chosen. To be chosen means, as Jacob discovers, a life of high demands and great hardship. Few and evil have been the days of my life, Jacob says to Pharaoh. But not to be chosen is also deeply disturbing. We see this time and again. On the two occasions in which Hagar is sent away, because Hagar is not chosen, and in the relations between Joseph and his brothers, because Joseph was chosen and preferred by his father and given a coat of multiple colors, and his brothers were not. But most explicitly, we see this of being chosen and not chosen in the tensions between Leah and Rachel. Jacob also married Rachel, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. God saw that Leah was hated. Sachs says, I have translated this last phrase literally to give its full shocking force in the Hebrew. Leah, of course, was not hated. She was loved. Rachel was only loved more. Yet the sense of rejection cuts deep, so deep that the Torah does not hesitate to compare it to the feeling of being hated. And one who feels rejected may hate in return. That is why the brothers hate Joseph. And that verb is used three times, which is a significant repetition in Hebraic literature. Love chooses. Think about this. Sachs writes, love chooses, but choice creates estrangement, which leads to tension, which can sometimes erupt into conflict and violence, potential or actual. This is a theme signaled almost at the beginning of the biblical narrative, where God's choice of Abel's offering and not Cain's leads to fratricide. Something of the deepest possible consequence is being intimated in the story of Esau. The choice of one does not mean the rejection of the other. So I invite you to just let that one soak in for a little bit. The choice of one does not mean the rejection of another. Only in a culture that embraces dualism, only in a culture or a society that tends to see everything through a binary lens, it's either right or it's wrong. We either have the right answer or we have the wrong answer. Because binary or dualism does not provide for more than one answer to the question. It does not provide for more than one being right. And dualism has been a part of the foundation of Western society ever since Western society was established. And most of the systems that exist inside Western culture tend to be dualistic or binary. There can only be one right. And if one is chosen, the others are rejected. Sachs again says, love chooses, but choice creates estrangement. And he says, something of the deepest possible consequences being intimated in the story of Esau. The choice of one does not mean the rejection of the other. Esau is not chosen, but he is also not rejected. He too will have his blessing, his heritage, his land, Did we not see in the Torah that God blessed him through Isaac, and that God gave he and his descendants land, and God gave instructions to Israel to not subdue that land or to mess, if you will, with the Edomites, but to give them respect? He too will have his virtues recognized, above all his love and respect for his father. Not accidentally are our sympathies drawn to him. Speaking of Esau, the Torah is saying for all time to all humanity, not all are chosen for the rigors, spiritual and existential, of the Abrahamic covenant. Not everyone is chosen for this, but all are precious to God. Each has his or her place in the scheme of things. Each has his or her virtues, talents, gifts, and each is precious in the eyes of God. In the words God will later say to Jonah, "You are concerned about this vine, though you did not tend it or make it grow. Nineveh has more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from the left, and many cattle as well. Should I not be concerned about that great city?" Or, as the Psalms puts it, "The Lord is good to all. He has compassion on all he has made." To be chosen does not mean that others are unchosen. To be secure in one's relationship with God does not depend on negating the possibility that others too may have a different relationship with him. In other words, reaching back to what I mentioned a moment ago, our relationship with God and God's relationship with all of humanity is not a zero-sum game. This is not a relationship where some who are privileged and chosen get a bigger slice of the pie, or a bigger slice of the prize, or they're more valued, or they're loved, and everyone else is rejected. God's relationship with those who are created in his image according to his likeness is not a zero-sum game where there are winners and then there are losers. That is a Western culture idea of dualism, and that is not consistent with Torah. To be chosen does not mean that others are unchosen. To be secure in one's relationship with God does not depend on negating the possibility that others too may have a different relationship with him. Jacob was loved by his mother. Esau loved by his father. But what of God, who is neither father or mother, but both, and more than both? In truth, we can only know our own relationship with our parents. We can never know another person's relationship with their parent. Am I loved more than my brothers or sisters? Am I loved less? Once asked, the question cannot but lead to sibling rivalry. In other words, to even pose the question to a parent, "Which child do you love more?" Or to pose the question to the child, "Which of you and your siblings are loved more or loved less by your parents?" That very question, if it's entertained, can only lead to sibling rivalry, which is one of the central themes of Genesis. But the question, Sack says, is not a valid question. It should not be asked. A good parent loves all his or her children and never thinks of more or less. Again, the idea of being more or less is a dualistic idea. Love is not quantifiable. It rejects comparisons. Jacob is Jacob, heir to the covenant. Esau is Esau, doing what he does, being what he is, enjoying his own heritage and blessing. What a simple truth, and how beautifully, subtly it is conveyed. It is one of the Torah's most profound messages to humanity, and how deeply, in an age of the clash of civilizations, the world needs to hear it today. That completes the article from Sachs. I want to quickly run through, and I recognize the time, and I don't want to belabor this, but I do want to reference some things from the apostolic writings. That's very important. first some of the words of Yeshua in Matthew 9:10. And as Yeshua reclined at the table in the house, and he's in the house of Matthew. And you might recall that Matthew was a tax collector at the time he and Yeshua meet. And as Yeshua reclined at the table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with Yeshua and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" Do you see the dualism at play here? We have the winners and the losers. We have the ones who are chosen, the ones who are not chosen. And in this case, the Pharisees are perplexed. Why are those who are not chosen eating at the same table and reclining with a Jewish rabbi who is clearly among those who are chosen? Yeshua says, but when he heard it, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick, go and learn what this means." And he quotes from Hosea 6, "I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." On another occasion, speaking to the same group of Pharisees in Matthew 23, Yeshua says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness." Listen closely to what Yeshua says. "These you ought to have done without neglecting the others." In other words, Yeshua is not going to play the dualistic game. He doesn't say that your tithing is not important, but justice, mercy, and faithfulness is important. He's not saying that one is not chosen and the other one is. He's not saying there's one is a loser and the other is a winner. He is saying all of this is important. So important that you should not neglect your tithing. But don't neglect justice, mercy, and faithfulness. "These you ought to have done without neglecting the others, you blind guides, straining out a gnat while swallowing a camel." The point being is that when we follow a dualistic pattern, when things are in a binary vision of being either right or wrong, that there's only one way, when that's our message, then we become a blind guide. Now think about that statement. What is the purpose and the role? What's the job of a guide? The job and the role of a guide is to provide sight in the direction we need to go and sight of the things that we should steer away from because they're dangerous. How can a guide do his or her job if they are blind? And that's the comment Yeshua is making about those who take a dualistic approach, who see things as either being right and fully right and others being fully wrong. When we tend to look at the world through this kind of a lens, we tend to be the blind guide. Paul writes in Corinthians, and this is a lengthy passage, and I'm not going to take time to read the whole thing, but it's something you're familiar with, and I encourage you to read this. He says, "For the body does not consist of one member, but many. If the foot should say, 'Because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body,' that would not make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, 'Because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body,' that would not make it any less a part of the body." He goes on to say, "But as it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them, as he chose. If we were all a single member, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body." The point being is that which is the correct body part, the eye or the ear? Kind of a ridiculous question, isn't it? Because the eye is an eye, an ear is an ear. And you never expect your ears to see any more than you would expect your eyes to hear. Would you imagine your feet doing the walking? except for in a clown act. It just isn't what we do, is it? But what happens when an eye and an ear come together in an integrated, cooperative way? What happens when hands and feet are cooperative together? And even more so, when one individual who is totally not like another individual comes together and they have an integrated, cooperative, collaborative relationship. And Paul goes on to write in 1 Corinthians 13, if I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am nothing more than a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And you're familiar with this passage in 1 Corinthians 13. But look with me in verse 4, because it's describing what love is. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. Why are these points important for us to consider in light of this article, The Other Face of Esau? Because when we tend to look at the world through a dualistic lens, the ones who believe they are the chosen tend to look at the ones that they believe are not the chosen, and they are not patient with them, and they are not kind. They do envy, and they boast, and they are arrogant, and they are rude in how they treat one another. And that is not the description that we read here in this commentary. Paul says love never ends. He's not saying that there's no place for prophecy. He's not saying that there's no place for knowledge. He's saying, what good is there having knowledge or prophecies if we don't also have love? He's not negating one to accept the other. We have to come together. In the last page of the notes, I just wanted you to appreciate that this idea of diversity is illustrated in the times, the appointed times of the Lord and the traditions. So if you think about the appointed time of Passover and the Passover Seder table, there are the four types of children and their questions. There's the heedless child that asks the question, what is the meaning of this service? In other words, this child is unconcerned. There's the foolish child that asks, what's happening? Because this child is actually uninterested. There's the dull child who doesn't ask any questions whatsoever. This child is unaware. And then there's the wise child who asks lots and lots of questions because they want to know the meaning of everything. And this is the discerning child. So at the Seder table, there are people who are unconcerned, uninterested, unaware, and there are those who are discerning. And guess what? They're all invited to the table. They all have a place at the table. They're not categorized. The first three are not eliminated because they don't fit in. Everyone's welcome to the table. Look at the four species that we bring together at the time of Sukkot. The etrog, the myrtle branch, the date palm, and the willow. Each of them represents a different kind of person. There's the person that's represented that it has both wisdom and good deeds. Then there's the person that's represented that has wisdom, but they don't do any good deeds. Then there's a third kind of person. They have good deeds, but they don't have any wisdom. And then there's the fourth kind of person who neither has wisdom or good deeds. And guess what? All four are welcome to the Sukkot. All four are brought together. And in fact, if any one of those elements is missing, then the wave offering is no longer kosher. Everyone is invited. There is not a prerequisite on being invited to the table of the Lord. A similar principle is taught by the composition of the incense that was used in the temple. That incense recipe had 11 ingredients. One of those ingredients, the chobanah, was a spice that had an absolutely horrible smell to it. And if you left it out, then you did not have the proper recipe, and that incense was not considered kosher, was not acceptable in the holy temple. To be acceptable, you had to include the spice that had a horrible smell. And yet the incense, when it was brought together, took on a whole different aroma when that one horrible smell is blended with the other 10. So what is our point in this lesson? What do you think it is? I'm going to give that to you as an opening question as I turn to you and for your comments. What do you hear? What do you find most relevant in today's Parsha and in your life?
I think for me that the greatest thing that I have sort of like been challenged to think about tonight was the fact that if you're not chosen, that doesn't mean you're rejected. And so many times, particularly in Western society, if you're not chosen, then you are rejected and you need to get your life right so you can be chosen. So to me, that is a very neat and hopeful thing that, you know, we have to, you know, to think about and to ponder. To me, it's really a lovely thought.
It is, David. Thank you for your comment and sharing. Absolutely. Thank you.
Roderick?
Yes, Andrea.
It's interesting because today and yesterday I've been reading Martin Luther King's speech at the Dexter Baptist Church. And this is one where he talks about the different kinds of love, the loving your enemies. But it's interesting because he says, you know, one of the ways to love your enemies is you need to see the good in your enemy. Because God is basically using them as well. And this just seems to fall in really well. Like even if you have an enemy, God still loves them. And you need to recognize that. And they're included at the table, as you kind of have put it. So it was a very lovely tie-in to what I just read.
Andrea, thank you for that comment and that insight referencing Dr. King. I think also what I hear in that same message and what I hear in today's Parsha is that it's one thing to have this view of someone who is our enemy, seeing that we can grow and benefit from our enemies. But there's another point here, I think, too, that Dr. King and this Torah portion is making, and that is not everyone that we perceive to be an enemy is our enemy. It might be that they're not us. They're not like us. They don't believe what we believe. They don't do what we do. And they're very different. And their walk and their relationship with the Lord is not at all like our walk or our relationship with the Lord. But we perceive them as an enemy when in fact they are not. Just like Jacob perceived that Esau at their reunion was going to hurt him, to try to take advantage of him, to destroy him or to attack him. And so Jacob was going through all these exercises to appease what he thought was an angry brother and to prepare his family for war. When in fact, none of that was realized, when in fact, Esau wanted to reconcile. That's not because Esau was forgiving. It was not because Esau was now going to walk in the ways of the Lord as Jacob understood walking in the ways of the Lord. Not everyone has the same kind of relationship with God that you have or that I have. And when we stop seeing them as enemies and we start seeing one another as co-participants on the earth, co-repairers, that we all have a connection with the Lord, even though it be different. That can be very transforming. Thank you, Andrea, for your comment in reference to Dr. King.
Thank you.
Hey, Roderick.
Hey, Tina.
Hey, so I caught in the beginning that Genesis says that their moms know their kids better.
That was a comment from Jonathan Sachs that when we read through the Genesis narrative, consistently we see what is portrayed in the characters is that mothers tend to have a better understanding of their children than the fathers do.
Sorry.
See, you're a mom and you understand that. See, you just lived out the principle right there.
That was not expected. I didn't know. I missed it.
Be right there, Isabel.
I didn't know if I missed it, how it tied into anything else later in the study. I just thought I could get a little clarification on
that. Sure. So with what I just shared, did that help or did you ever?
I think that's true.
David thinks that that's true even now. So there you go.
Okay.
Yeah. See, that's not suggesting that fathers don't know their children or can't come to know their children. What Sachs is commenting on is that in the Genesis narrative, among the stories that are introduced to us in the Genesis narrative, of those narratives, mothers are portrayed as understanding their children and having a closer connection with them than the fathers. And that's an observation from Sachs. That should not be seen as a Torah principle. That's simply a commentary from Jonathan Sachs. And so you can disagree with that and you're not violating Torah. And there are those who would probably, as David just explained or commented on, that they find that to be true from their point of view or from their experience. And my wife is here. She's not on camera, but she's here with me. And we both have talked about this a great deal. We raised three children who are now grown adults. And so from the time they were born until age 13 or 14, my wife knew them much better than I knew them. Each one of them turned 13, my wife came to me each time and said, "They're no longer mine, they're yours." She meant that in a humorous way. She's always been their mother. And so it might be that there was a season that maybe I understood them more so than my wife. And I put that in quotes. Maybe that's true. I would not be real firm about that. But, again, that's just a commentary from Jonathan Sachs for you to look at and evaluate.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Tina. In the chat room, Beth Ann said that she was looking forward to today's teaching. And Beth Ann, I hope you were not disappointed. I appreciate your comments, Shelley, and that you found this today uplifting. And Elmer, thank you for your comments and always appreciated. Sunflower writes, and by the way, Shabbat Shalom, Sunflower. She says, Shabbat Shalom. Does this type of understanding come from a lack of proper teaching? My reference is from the teaching in the church where I was taught that Cain was rejected and outcasted. Esau was hated. Is this more about getting a Hebrew mindset? You may have touched on this already. I came in late, so apologies. So, as Sachs was illustrating in his article, the Torah uses a strong language intentionally, but it's a narrative language. It's not legal language. It tends to be much more poetic than for a strict interpretation. In other words, it's not that God hates Esau any more than he hated Cain, because God does not hate. God's rejection of Cain's offering is not a rejection of Cain. And God's choice of Jacob is not a rejection of Esau in the terms of, we might imagine a rejection being someone turning their back on another person. That's not what is communicated in the text. What is communicated is that God's choice of Jacob from Esau's point of view on an emotional level was as if he had been rejected and as if he was hated. It's communicating the intensity of emotions, not the reality. You understand? There are times that we can perceive something that is not real, but the perception can be very, very, very intense on an emotional plane for us human beings. I don't know if you've ever had the occasion. When I was a child, I played with neighborhood kids, and we would choose up teams and play basketball, or we'd choose up teams and play football. And I remember when I was much younger, it was the older kids who became the captains, and the captains would choose from the pool of the neighborhood kids that was standing around. So one would choose, and then the other one choose, and it's back and forth until you had your teams. And what is the anxiety that every child has in that scenario? It's the same whether you live in New York or LA or Phoenix, Arizona, or, you know, somewhere else in the world. The anxiety is the same. Am I going to be chosen last? That's the same anxiety. And I've had that, you know, I was not particularly gifted with athletic ability, so often I was the last one chosen. And that would almost always have a comment, oh, you got Roderick. Yay, we don't get Roderick. He's on the other team. Nobody meant to hurt me from their point of view. No one was trying to intentionally inflict pain and insult me from their point of view. But from my point of view, can you imagine that, how that intensity of that rejection, right? And if there was anything else going on in my life that was negative, well, that only made this story, this moment, even worse. Because our moments get embellished by our past painful learning. That's what that means. That's what that's about. Again, Beth Ann, thank you for your comment, and glad you found this an enlightening experience. And anyone else have a story to share or a comment to make? The aspects of the lesson have immediate relevance to me, thinking about how I felt when I was growing up with two sisters and two brothers, loved less. Rejected, no, but I perceive it that way, and that affected how I raised my kids. I measured the pieces of candy so that I would not feel favored. No one would feel favored over the other. Ed, you just read a chapter from my own book. Oh my gracious. I have expended so much energy and have suffered so much stress that I brought on myself because I was trying to equalize the disbursements of the good things for my children. And I tend to want to do the same thing with my grandkids. And the truth is, not all the slices of the cake are going to be the same. And we see this illustrated in a parable of Yeshua when he talks about the talents and how they're dispersed. One gets 10, one gets 5, one gets 1. And they're dispersed how? They're not dispersed equally, but the text in the Gospels tells us what's the basis for the disbursement or the apportionment. According to each one's ability. You know, it's loving when we give what another person can handle. And it's not loving when we give them more than they can handle. So love calls for you and I to be in a relationship. And because the relationship informs us on how to care. And how to be a benefit. And God loved Esau. Isaac loved Esau. And Esau and his family and his descendants were cared for and they were provided for according to what they could handle. And that's what love does. Charlene comments, Roderick, what struck me from the lesson was that Esau and Jacob parted as enemies, but they were brothers, and that reconciliation still happened after all those years. That was a comforting thought. It was a great lesson. Yes, it is a great lesson for us today. And not in this article, but in another article you can read, where Sachs writes that he looks forward to the day when Israel and Islam and Christianity will be united. Not because we all became the same, but because we have come to respect one another. And in a dualistic world where there can only be one right and everyone else is wrong, that will not happen. So in order for that to happen, we have to move away from dualism, move away from binary thinking, and embrace diversity. And if you go back to the email that you got today when you got the notes, you will see another quote that I gave from Jonathan Sachs, and I'm going to reference that, and then we will close the evening in our study. But this is a quote. Sachs writes, "The glory of creation is that unity in heaven creates diversity on earth. The unity in heaven creates diversity on earth. God wants every human life to be unique. Sameness is not unity." You look at all these faces right now on your screen. None of us look the same. None of us have the same history. And while we might have some elements of shared belief, we have other beliefs that are very different. You have a point of view. The person next to you on the screen has a different point of view. And that's beautiful. And our unity is not meaning that we all have to change to become like one thing. We only have to be honest and authentic with the purpose that the Creator created us for. And when we are committed to that, and when we're honest and authentic about that, and we respect what is not like us. Because what connects us all is that in all of our differences, we still hold the image of the single God and his likeness. God has lots of likenesses, and yet there's only one likeness. And that oneness is in our plurality. And that's a wonderful thing. It's a difficult thing to embrace sometimes, but only because of our past painful learning. So thank you for being a part of this today. Any other thoughts before we close?
I have a thought.
Yes.
Number one, I just wanted to thank you. I have really learned a lot today. But also, now I understand when they talked about the ears and the eyes and the hands and the feet. And that's just like the chosen and the unchosen. And so everybody have a purpose, and we all as one. And when you was talking about that, that's when, because I always heard that, like the eyes and the ears, you know, which one is important. And we all are important. And I just want to thank you. That was a good lesson today.
Thank you, Benita, for your comment. Please give my regards to Mark. Okay, anyone else? Well, I thank you again. For those of us here in Arizona, it's the new week. So Shavuot Tov, if that's true for you. Andrea, is it still Sabbath?
For about 45 more minutes. It's only 3:30, so.
Well, Shabbat Shalom to you. And for the rest of us, Shavuot Tov. May the Lord provide for you a wonderful, wonderful week coming. And we look forward to next week's study. Bob will be back as the Lord provides. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.